Thanks, Jerry. I would like to introduce tonight's speaker. We have John from La Jolla. Welcome, John.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
And I'm looking out over this crowd and what a wonderful group it is. I am so privileged to have been invited by John H. to come down as the speaker. Frankly, I knew very little about South Bay Pioneers. I'd never been here before, and it's totally remarkable. My eyes have been open to AA for a reasonably long time, but this is a real eye-opener. What a wonderful facility it is, and how many thousands of people have been helped by this facility. I can't imagine how many there are. When I mention that, I always think, how little people outside of AA know what's going on in AA, you know? I don't know how many times I've heard young people get up and say that their family is saying, well, do you still have to go to those meetings, you know? And but that's the way it is. We're blessed. Let me welcome the newcomer, Jaime. I wish you the best, you know? I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know how things are with you. You've heard a person take a 35-year cake. It's not you don't have to worry about 35 years. Worry about this evening and then tomorrow morning when you get up and take care of those, and it'll work out. And Jim, congratulations on that 35. That's wonderful. And I don't know you, but from what you said, you've been doing a lot of work in AA here. Is that true at the Pioneer?
Yeah, here.
For 25 years? That's wonderful. Good to hear that. Okay, a couple of statistics. I got sober on June 10th, 1988, and I didn't know anything about AA. I'll tell you how it all came about. But that's the anniversary date of AA, June 10th. And so I've been able to celebrate every year, you know. Okay, and then I've been married for 63 years, monogamously. Same woman, 63 years. And I am blessed. She is, thank you. She's a wonderful person, and I can't tell you how much she's put up with over those years. It's beyond my belief, you know. And then I'm 87 years old. And I just feel great, you know, like Jim said, he feels great. I feel great, too. And I was thinking of Joe Biden being only 81 years old and how I could handle the presidency without a problem, you know? And I would be one hell of a lot more animated, but don't have to worry about him. Okay, back to me. I was born in Carlsbad, New Mexico, February 13th, 1937, and my parents were both teachers, and we moved, after I was only about 6 months old, back to where they grew up, and that was in Pittsburgh, Kansas. And we moved there. My parents were very active. My mom's family was very prominent in that little town. And then during the Second World War, my dad, who was a draftsman, heard of all the jobs that were available on the West Coast, and particularly in shipbuilding, and he got a job with Kaiser Shipbuilding in Richmond, California, and we moved our family from Pittsburgh, Kansas, out to Richmond, California. And we had a 1939 Lincoln Zephyr, and there were four kids, so there were six of us, and my mother's father was prominent in the labor union in Pittsburgh, and he got used tires for the car. You couldn't get real new tires. He got used tires. They were stacked on the top. All of our belongings were stacked in the car. We were stacked in the car, and we took off. And my dad is dead, but he was an insane driver. And he drove that car so fast that one night we had six flat tires. And My brothers were capable, and they helped fix it. My mom took over the driving, and we got out to California okay and came to Richmond after a stop in L.A. And my mom became a teacher in the Richmond school system. I was a student of hers. And my dad worked in the shipyards. And we lived in those housing developments. If you've ever been to Richmond, probably haven't been to Richmond. But anyway, all along this boulevard, the government had built these housing units, and we lived in them. And it was okay living. We had lots of kids, and it was one hell of a lot of fun. And then the war ended, and both my mom and dad wanted to seek the best place for the kids to go to school and grow up. And they selected Piedmont, a little town. Oakland surrounds it, next to Berkeley. And we moved to Piedmont in 1946. And I grew up there, went through high school, and then went back east to go to college at George Washington in Washington, D.C. But it was during my high school years, during all my years growing up, I neither smoked nor drank. My parents neither smoked nor drank. And I did, none of my friends did. We were straight shooters. But when the last year of athletics were over in the spring of 1955, one person got us together, got six of us together. We went to his house, and his family had an enormous liquor closet. And we each took a bottle of booze. First time we'd ever done anything like that. I took a bottle of sweet vermouth. I know. And we went to the hills in Berkeley. I drank that whole thing. And I can't tell you how sick I got. I vomited in my best friend's, the back seat of his dad's Chrysler. They took me home. I was passed out. They didn't know where I slept in the house. They put me in bed with my sister. And I vomited on her. And my parents came in, they cleaned me up, and I don't know how I ever got to my bed. The next morning, I can't tell you the electricity in that house, you know? My mother was so disappointed in me. I had never done anything like this. They didn't expect I would. I did, though. And my dad was just angry. He was a very tough person anyway. And I survived that. And you would think that that would have been an eye-opener. Like alcoholics, you know, I had no feeling of alcoholism prior to having that drink. I had that bottle, and then a couple of weeks later, we went down to this grocery store that served booze to minors, and we bought six packs of Country Club malt liquor and went back up to the hills. And this time, I was going to do it without having to get sick. And I did it. And then that started the cycle of me drinking, because I found at that time, when I survived that, booze did something for me that I didn't feel I could do for myself. I felt better. I felt like I fitted in. I could do things. I showed off more and all of that stuff, you know? And I started drinking somewhat regularly. And then when I went to college, I really started drinking, because I was away from home. I was on my own. And I was living in a fraternity house in Washington, D.C. And while other people were studying, I was screwing around, drinking, partying, going places, doing things. And the university put up with me for 2 years. And finally, the dean of men said, John, we've strung with you as long as we can. We're going to have to suspend you for some period of time. So they sent me out for a year. I went to a little school, an accounting school, during that year, then came back to college and changed my behavior. I cut back on the drinking, increased the studying, and graduated. Okay, not totally true, because during my last year or so in college, I was at a birthday party for me at the fraternity house, and this group of girls, two or three girls, came to this party because at George Washington, they had so many government workers that came there at night to get masters and PhDs that they had a smaller day school, actually, than they did a night school. And so the many classes were at night. My wife had a night class. My wife-to-be had a night class. She came. I saw her. And as I'm looking at people, it was love at first sight. I was drunk as a skunk. And I danced with her, and We made arrangements to meet next weekend. I wrote it down on a piece of oilcloth, tablecloth at the fraternity that they wiped off. And I proceeded to get drunk and passed out. Completely forgot about that I had asked her out for a date. And we would pass each other on campus. And at the end of the week, she called me. And I picked up the phone. And I said, "Hi, is this Sue?" And her name is Rosina. "No, it's Rosina. And do we or don't we have a date?" Well, like the type of person I am, I stumbled and fumbled and talked my way into a date. And we started dating. And there were a couple of times when we didn't date. But from that period on, like we got married in 1960. So it was about 1957, 58 that we really started dating. And from that time on, I've been with her my entire life. And my drinking, I really slowed down on my drinking. However, for all of my drinking career after college, I drank more than most people did. And I'll tell you, I have a short version of my drunkalogue, if you'd like to hear it. The short version is in 1965, my wife and I were going through a checkbook that we had. And among the things it said, we lived in Washington, D.C. area. It said, Chesapeake and Potomac telephone, $7. Sun Oil, $9. D.C. telephone, $6. A&A liquor, $248. I should have known at the time, but no. The reason that it was $248, I was able to buy at A&A Liquor on Pennsylvania Avenue, half gallons of everything. Back in those days, a half gallon of scotch was like $7, and a half gallon of vodka was $4 or something. So I wanted to make sure that anyone who came to our house could get any drink they wanted, and I would make it for them, you know? And so we always had a load of booze, and I used it. I didn't go any place without having a couple of drinks beforehand to loosen up and to prepare socially, you know? I just did that. And when we got to where we were going, I would make sure that they poured me stiff drinks and that I got more than other people. Not more than all people, because I knew who the alcoholics were. And I can tell you today who the alcoholics were, two guys that drank more than I did, but just barely. So anyway, we went through that and had three children. Two of them are still alive today. Our youngest son, David, when he was going to be 22, first, he got into AA when he was 19, and he was a zealot. He did everything, volunteered, worked with people, sponsored people, did service, was a zealot. And at one time, after about 2.5 years, he went out. And nothing we or he or his friends, none of us, could talk him into coming back or changing his ways. He would periodically do things, and we thought he was doing one of those things periodically, going to school up in San Francisco. And if he were going to school or paying or working, we would support him. And so we thought he was going to school in San Francisco, and we went up to visit my parents in Piedmont and then go over to San Francisco to see our son. We saw him, things looked good. We came home. And one night, on April 29th, 1992, we got a call from the San Francisco Sheriff's Department saying, "Your son has died, and he's in our morgue. He died of two speedballs." People from where we lived went up to San Francisco as young people, and they got together, and they did booze together. And when he did the second speedball, he was unconscious at that time, and they didn't know, or they didn't. No one took care of him. He went home, fell asleep in bed, and died. And so that was April 29th, 1992. We flew up to San Francisco, saw his body, and brought him back home. And I can't tell you, I was 3.5 years sober at that time. And it was such an eye-opener how the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm not from Missouri, but I'm like one of those show-me people, you know? And I had no real experience with how the fellowship, how our friends, the people I knew, buddies I had, friends of my wife's, how they would come to our rescue and do things for us during this time of crisis. It was wonderful. And I would ask, how many of you have experienced similar things? I'll bet you most hands would go up here. Yep, because that's just how it is. And it's so powerful and so wonderful. And we pulled through that satisfactorily, you know? And our lives, it took a while. I'll say this, my wife probably still feels some responsibility, you know? It's hard to give up on, it's hard not to take responsibility for something like that happening. And thanks to AA, my sponsors, people I've talked to, others who've had the same things, I've been able to deal with it more directly, I think. My wife's not in the program, but anyway, that's what happened, and we've moved on from there. Well, I've had a blessed life in AA. Dave Patton reminded me of one thing before. My wife, and Jim, you said about a 10-year token. Well, I asked my wife to give me a token when I had 10 years at the North Shore Zolano Club. And she started off and said some nice things. And then she said, well, one thing about John, he's so simple-minded. And I agreed with her. I didn't like it because, you know, when you're giving a token, you have to say nice things, right? Well, the simple-minded part was truthful because what she really meant was, when I came in, and I'll tell you how I came in. When I came in, I didn't fight the God concept. I didn't fight the steps concept. I slid in. I slithered in like a snake. That son I told you about that died went to the McDonald Center before his death, and we attended AA meetings out there, family support meetings out there. And before we would go, I'd have a couple of drinks because it was kind of boring. But anyway, just to get prepared. And we'd go to those meetings. And then, like in September of 87, I flunked an insurance physical. I was applying for a substantial insurance policy, and I flunked it. Because they said those your liver enzymes are a little out of whack, and they were. But I tried to get my doctor to say that it's because I had a cold, some excuse, you know, so I could get it, and they wouldn't accept it. And so I did something terribly dangerous for an alcoholic. I told my wife I was worried about my drinking. Oh, I know. Well, she said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I'm going to go to an acupuncturist. And I went to this acupuncturist just around the corner on La Jolla Boulevard. And I went through a series of treatments. And one of them was they put like 4 needles in me. And one of the needles was attached to an electrical line and plugged into the wall to a rheostat. And I'd be lying on this table in shorts with these needles in me, and she would turn up the rheostat on the electrical cord, and I'd be shaking. And I could just imagine a room full of people like this, all stretched out, vibrating, stopping drinking. Well, during the sessions, I stopped drinking. As soon as the sessions were over, I went back to drinking. And And then it was during those sessions at the McDonald Center, one day when I was there as a parent support person, and his counselor and my wife, another person, and our son David was there. And David said to the counselor, "Well, why don't you ask my dad about his drinking?" And pulled the plug on me. And they looked at me, and my wife said, "Well, what about it, John?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic. I've got to stop drinking." And we talked about how to do it and what I should do. And 2 days later, I stopped. And I haven't had a drink since. Now, you might think, well, there now he'll get active in AA like his son was, and he'll do things. Uh-uh. I went to meetings, but I was one of those people, I went on time and I left on time. I didn't raise my hand when they asked for newcomers. I made a mistake. I went to this Mary Star of the Sea meeting at a Catholic church in La Jolla where you had to raise your hand for 90 days. And I wasn't going to do that. So I didn't introduce myself. But I went to those meetings. And one day, after a couple of months, the leader of it, a guy whom I know today very, very well, came up to me. He was the secretary of the meeting. He came up to me and he says, "John, I see at this meeting and you don't do shit." And I admitted it. And he broke the ice for me. He introduced me to other people. He got me to go to a men's step study down at La Jolla Cove where there were people with a lot of experience. You probably knew, they're dead now, you probably knew Ergo Majors or Bill Brace, guys that at that time had 20-some years and died with 50 years of sobriety. Well, anyway, I went to that. And what happened for me is not that I had a God moment, not that a burning bush happened or that, but I heard what they said their lives were like and how their lives were going. And I started to want what they had. And it started dawning on me. I started changing my attitude on things. There's this one little couple sentences in the book after we read how it works. It says, "Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, are at the root of our problems." And I can't tell you, that was me in spades. I had to have things go my way. I worked my entire life to support the family and to get things done the way I wanted them done. And I would almost do anything to get things the way I wanted them. And I tell you, as soon as I heard about that and heard how people dealt with their lives and the same feelings they had, I started changing my behavior. And I started letting go, dropping the rock, as we used to say, letting people have their way, me not having to have it my way all the time. And what a relief that was. And then I did a national executive search, and I found a sponsor. And it was almost like that. He was a retired vice president of Ford Motor International. He had gone to the Hazelden Institute and gotten a certificate on alcoholic care. A terribly esteemed person, and he became my sponsor. Well, when he became my sponsor, he wasn't so esteemed. He was very direct, demanding, and put me on the track. We worked the steps in detail. He kept close touch with me on how I was leading my life and what I was doing to better myself, dealing with people. And he was just a wonderful person. And I got to love that guy. He has since died. Mike Collins was his name. He got Parkinson's and then got seriously ill and subsequently died. But the time we were together, like for nearly 17 years, he rebuilt my life for me and put me on the right track. I am so blessed. I would definitely be dead if I had not gotten into AA. Before I got into AA, I was diagnosed with this liver illness called primary sclerosing cholangitis, PSC. And what it is, it's where your bile ducts start failing. and it takes time. Let's see, I got sober in 88, and I was diagnosed with this in 83, and up until 2010, we tracked it, and every couple of months I'd go in for a biopsy on my liver. They would track it, and slowly but surely, my health declined. My color started changing. People who saw me just before I was yellow, they thought I was Asian, that I was yellow. And then I applied for and got a liver transplant. And I'll tell you, the way we got it was my wife and I got on the internet. We were pointed to an internet site called National Association of something organs. Can't think of it right this second. Well, we got on it and we saw transplant centers all over the country. And we started zeroing in on the ones who did the most and had the fewest people waiting. And we applied at Indiana University Med Center in Indianapolis, got accepted. And I tell you, for those of you who are on Medicare paid for our airfare and our apartment rent while we were there. We moved back. I got the liver in 7 weeks, and I got it. We went there August 1st. I got it in September the 10th, and we stayed until December to recover and come home. And I have been blessed. It's worked out perfectly. And since that time, I've had a chance to refer two other people to the same thing, who went back to Indiana and also received livers in short order. And one who didn't and subsequently died. But I am so blessed that happened. And it was because of the initiative of my wife and some friends that put us on the track. And so today, and the doctor that did the transplant, two doctors, Dr. Fidel and Dr. Mangus, when they gave me the liver, they said, "We made a Mercedes incision on you," and it looks like this, like a Mercedes symbol. Okay. "But we gave you a Porsche liver," and a perfect match. So, and it was, well, in Indiana they don't have helmet laws for motorcyclists, and therefore they have a very high incident of motorcycle accidents where people are brain dead. And I got the organs from a 21-year-old kid who killed himself that way. I'm blessed. So that's how it's gone for me, you know. Trying to think of another significant thing. Give me a moment. Pardon me?
How'd you go to Mount Soledad?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Nick. Well, I first went to meetings right around La Jolla, and then I heard about this meeting up on the hill, Soledad Men's, and I went to it. And it's like this. It's a men's meeting, but it's a lot of people just like this. And there's so much support and so many good people, several of them are here this evening, that it's just wonderful. I am blessed to have gotten into AA and to started going to that meeting too. And I've been going to it for 36 years, so I've gotten to know it pretty well. And I think that's just about it for me, you know? I am so lucky to have gotten into AA, and I know most of you feel the same way about yourselves. And an important thing, I've been able to, I don't mean to brag about this, but I've changed my behavior, my attitude, my beliefs, how I conduct myself, how I treat other people, how I do things significantly differently than I did. And that's totally as a result of AA. And and my life, well, my life has gotten so good. I haven't had to work for 26 years, and I'm 87, for Christ's sake. As I told you, I have a loving wife. We have enough money that we get along. We live in a good place, active in AA. And I'm saying, what more could I ask for, you know? Nothing. So anyway, it's my privilege to be here. This is a remarkable operation. My eyes are opened. I hope it's not the last time I come here. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to me.